Welcome, everyone, to a very special episode of Podcasting Softly. This is Nick, and of course, I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, buddy?
Hello.
What's going on, man?
Oh, not much. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Actually, doing great.
I got to edit that opening, because you guys can do better than that. Come on. That was like Crockett and Tubbs at their first audition. You gotta bring me some life. You guys ever met? You guys are buds. You're simpatico. It's got to be like a run across the airport and give a hug. You just arrived home. Let's make some
fun right,
happen here.
All right, fine. We'll redo it. Go ahead, redo it.
All right,
I'll
redo
do
it,
my
you guys.
Flounder.
Don't edit out the front, because people need to understand the difference between the first take and the second take.
This is going to be raw, straight up raw. There's going to be no editing done to this Toddcast.
Hide the children.
Not for a spoiler. Go ahead. Okay. So anyway, re-roll it, Nick.
Welcome, everyone, to a very, very special episode of Podcasting Them Softly. This is Nick, and of course, I'm joined by Frank. What's going on, bud?
This podcast is the pinnacle of my life. I can't even. I
Colin
can't
Farrell
even
is not
wait.
On this call. I don't know if you misread your schedule, but I'm sorry. Colin was delayed at the airport, but
I can't even wait for people to listen to this and be like, "Who the fuck is this guy?" Because we haven't even done an introduction yet. This is amazing.
This is a podcaster. I'm jumping out fast.
But yes, joining us tonight for clearly a fun chat is screenwriter Todd Komarnicki, whose new film Sully from director Clint Eastwood lands in theaters this weekend. This is really cool. Frank and I are very pumped to see it. We're big fans of Clint Eastwood in general. Todd's got some very interesting credits, screenplay for James Foley on Perfect Stranger. He's also produced the family classic Elf with Will Ferrell, which is a constant holiday treat every year. And he's also prepping a project both as writer and director called The God Four with Michael Douglas, Jay Courtney, Natalie Dormer, Brenton Thwaites. So hopefully find out a little bit about that. But right now, all attention is certainly on Sully. It's riding all sorts of great buzz. We can't wait to see it. So welcome to the show, Todd. Thanks so much for chatting with us. It's a real pleasure.
Oh, forget about it. The pleasure is mine. You guys, be yanking your chain here. What you guys are doing and your podcasting and you're writing about movies, your love for movies, it just permeates every sentence you put down. And people need to be in love with movies, because movies are an art form that need a little protection. When our screens are getting smaller and smaller, we're going to be watching movies on our thumbnails pretty soon. So the love of movies and their impact in our culture and their place in our art, it's a big deal. And you guys are keeping the flag flying. So thank you.
That's awesome, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Can you repeat that?
Yeah, can you repeat that?
No, but yes. Seriously, thank you very much, man. I mean, Nick and I absolutely love doing what we do, and it's surreal to get to be able to speak to people like you, and it makes it all worthwhile for us. Regardless of if people read or listen to our stuff, it's just so much fun because – like you said, we love movies more than anything, so this is just an incredible treat.
Can I ask you about the genesis of the whole power thing, and you guys write and you do back and forth with your friends? From whence does the power come?
This is actually cool that you asked this. Okay. The power thing started back when I was living in Los Angeles. I wrote a review, and you can probably find it somewhere. I wrote a review, and it was posted either at Ain't It Cool News, or it was posted at Movie City News, or one of those websites back in the day. I think it was Ain't It Cool. And I had seen a test screening of Michael Bay's The Island. And I came out of the movie all fired up. I loved it, the jet bike, the whole thing. And when I was leaving the screening, I said, you know what, I'm going to go home. I'm going to pound out a review on Ain't It Cool. You know, it'll be up the next day. And like halfway through the review, I said something to the effect of Michael Bay full-on power, or Michael Bay power. This movie is Bay power. And then I started to throw it around on a couple of blogs, and then other people started to throw it around. And, you know, here we are now, and I should have trademarked the thing.
Yeah, because when I first met Nick, I thought it was obnoxious and ridiculous, and I was just like, dude, you got to cut the shit with this power thing, and look at me now.
I thought it was off the Richard Gere movie, Power. I thought it all came from that.
Oh, my God. That's a whole other story. That you're not even ready for.
So that's Power?
Yeah, that's exactly that's exactly what happened when Nick covered Power.
I was completely unaware of the fact that Sidney Lumet had made a movie called Power. And I would say probably about three months ago or four months ago, I think it was a little while ago, I got the DVD finally and I watched it and it was damn good. It was way better than the people had given it credit for being in 1985. But yeah, that was definitely one of the more ironic pieces of writing that I ever had to try to do, because I don't think actually – I think Frank and I actually had a conversation about it. Should I actually say
no.
Power?
Yeah.
I actually went with no, don't do it. Because then it would just be completely ridiculous. So I actually I resisted temptation and didn't drop one uppercase power bomb throughout the whole review. So,
yeah.
And were you okay? I mean, did you strain a hamstring by holding all that power back?
No, you want to know who took the brunt of this? Was me, because for a couple weeks I would wake up at 5:30 in the morning when my alarm clock went off. I'd shut it off on my phone, and I'd have like six messages from Nick. All of Richard Gere sweating with his mustache, that would just be power, power. And this happened for quite a while. This happened from the point to where Nick discovered this movie to the point where he got the DVD to the point where he took screenshots from the DVD. So this was probably like a good 2.5 weeks of my life.
You sure it wasn't his infant child sending you those screenshots?
I'm positive.
Kids are tech savvy. You know what they can do.
What I'm going to do after this Toddcast is I'm just going to start sending you screenshots from like every day for the past like year and a half at 5:30 in the morning of just how I wake up every morning to just an obscure still from some obnoxious movie.
You guys need to be sponsored by Power Bar.
Oh my God, that would be amazing. Powerade.
That would be amazing if we could get a sponsor. Any sponsor, really. I don't give a shit who the sponsor is.
you deserve a sponsor. You should build a meme of Richard Gere eating a power bar in Power. There'd be power
oh my
power
God.
Bar.
A power bar in one hand with a Powerade in the other hand standing on a live wire.
I love it. Make it happen. Come on, guys. Get working.
Right. Well, we should probably get down to business because obviously.
Please don't say in your review of Sully that it was a powerful film, please, because it will set your listeners off and they won't pay any attention except to the use of the word power. You know,
I just
power
imagine
shower.
People listening to this or reading our reviews of Sully. Just in the middle of the movie, standing up in the theater, screaming power, and then sitting back down.
Okay, well, I'm gonna have to end the podcast then, based on that. If that's gonna happen, that's good. Because I believe that you have enough influence to create that as a national cinematic problem.
Well,
that would be an amazing montage in a movie.
Maybe if they just whispered power, or they turned to their partner and nuzzled in close and mouthed the word power, but they shouldn't shout it out loud.
Well, it's one of those silly things, honestly, like I just didn't really think that people were going to latch onto. And I have to say, out of all of the idiocy that I've thrown up online over the last couple of years and like certain obsessions with certain movies, the power thing and the fact that people have embraced it, it's hysterical. Like, I'll queue up Facebook on my phone and I'll just see random comments on other people's threads that I haven't commented on. And I'll just see something like, you know, something or other power. And I just laugh my ass off. I'm just like, oh, that's great. People enjoy it. And then, of course, I've got people that say that it's completely obnoxious and why do you do it? So whatever. You can't please everybody.
Right. When my former film professor, who's been on our podcast a couple times, will message me about some movie and just she says she ends it with power and Nick's not even involved whatsoever in the thread. I mean, that's how you know this buffoonery is just off its leash.
When I was a young man, when I was a young man in my collegiate years, for some reason, the phrase that caught on for us was, I'll pay ya. Like, I'll pay you to take me to the movies. I'll pay you to get that girl's phone number. Anything was, I'll pay ya, I'll pay ya. And it became so common that we would just literally say nothing but, I'll pay ya. There'd not have to be anything connected to it. You just told, dude, I will pay you. Right now, I will pay you. And so I love the power of language. Here's a fun one to do with your friends out. We did this in L.A. probably about 10 years ago, made a commitment, me and two buddies, to just go out to dinner and only use the word Brenda. it is a delightful elixir, believe me. You try to order from your waitress, Brenda, a side of Brenda, and then Brenda, medium Brenda, you want some Brenda with your Brenda? And the whole staff, like, we shut the restaurant down because people could not stop laughing at the madness. So I'm a big fan of Power Brenda. I will represent Power Brenda. I'll pay you to get sponsored by Power Bar, and may the Brenda win.
Well,
I think we should end the podcast now.
I know.
I don't know if it's going to get any better than this.
I'm sure, but
Have you seen my new movie, Brenda? It's fantastic.
Is that the one that stars Brenda and Brenda?
Well, we originally were trying to cast Brenda, but Brenda was unavailable. So we made some calls, and fortunately, Brenda could do it. It was a tight Brenda, but we pulled it off. Is everybody okay? Did we wake up the kid?
Yeah, I see.
Is the dog all right?
I needed a sip of water. Typically,
yeah, he moved up. He moved up to the couch next to me right now, and he's side staring me.
Hey, are you guys based in Chicago? I saw the 312.
Frank,
I'm based in Chicago.
Frank's in the Windy City. I'm in Connecticut.
Oh, you're close to me, Nick.
Where are you living? New York?
Yeah, Manhattan, a lovely metropolitan area. Which part of Connecticut are you in?
I live in South Windsor, which is like 20
North
minutes.
Windsor. You got to get out. You got to get out of North Windsor, whatever you're doing. I'm glad you're from South Windsor.
Right, like 20 minutes from Hartford. So,
I went to third grade in West Hartford. So,
that's where I'm from.
You were unborn, but
wait, say that one more time.
You were long unborn. When I was rocking West Hartford and hanging out with Jimmy Hungerford and Paul Crosley, you were not a twinkle yet.
This is totally random and bizarre. You said Jimmy Hungerford?
Yeah.
Is that the baseball guy?
No, I mean, I don't know. He was just a kid that picked on me in third grade. You only remember the kids that are mean to you. Everybody else is fades in the end. Except for your wife and kids, you pretty much remember nobody except the bullies.
Interesting. I grew up in West Hartford. So born and raised there, you know, all schooling there and everything else. Hungerford is a name from Little League. There was a coach who was a very good coach, actually, if I recall. So I'm wondering if it was the same person, but if not, no big deal. But yeah, small world for sure.
I'm glad he turned out to be a good coach because he was a mean agent.
But yeah, Frank and I have actually never met. We've done the podcast.
Crazy. We got to have a reunion live video shoot of you guys meeting.
We still haven't met in the flesh. Everything's been just through Skype but you know, we've been very lucky and fortunate to have a lot of fun.
Well, you guys seem like old friends, and it's nice and easy to talk to you. And as I imagine, based on your writing and your passion about what you do, it's easy peasy chatting with you fellas.
Well, we're definitely looking forward to Sully. Certainly looks incredible. I have to ask, how did you get involved in this project? Because it's obviously so exciting, and it's one of the biggest movies of the year. And curious to know the genesis for you, how it came about.
John Berg was a very long time and dear friend of mine, and he and I produced Elf together. And he went on to wind up becoming an executive. He's now at the top of the DC Comics chain at Warner Brothers. You know how they made everything into these sort of silos now, and So he and Jeff Johns now supervise all the Justice League and the Batman stuff. And so he works at Warner Brothers now, but we've remained friends. And 2010, the end of 2010, he sent me a clipping that said Frank Marshall and Alan Stewart had optioned Sully's book for the movies. And he just emailed it to me and he said, I think you should write this movie. And John, when we were partners, he just had a knack for knowing what I should do next. He said an amazing instinct. So I was like, okay, I'm going to follow through on that. My first reaction actually was, do you think this is a Warner Brothers movie? Because he was an exec there, and this was pre-only cartoons, you know, and superheroes in his life. And he said, no, no, this is, you know, it's too small a movie. Warner Brothers would never make that movie. Ironically, years later, Warner Brothers made that very movie. So it's funny that we had that start. I read the book. I saw the movie very clearly in my head. I called my agent, and he arranged for me to get on the phone with the producers, and I was the first person to talk to them about the movie and laid out my vision for them. And Frank Marshall, who I'd never met at that point, said to me after a pause, he said, I feel like you tapped my brain and said out loud exactly the movie I see. So I'm in New York. They're in L.A. We have all these, you know, high fives and huzzas on the phone, and it feels like, you know, they're going to be sending me a check overnight. It was that good of a phone call. And that call was followed by 5 months of total silence. No check-in, no, hey, we're thinking about you, just total silence. As they went on a journey, as often happens in Hollywood, to talk to anybody who could hold a pen with an opposable thumb and see if there was somebody out there with a better version. And by the grace of God, after 5 months, I got a call, and they said, you were the first, and you were the one that stuck with us, so come on board.
Wow, that's awesome. And
a lot of patience.
Yeah.
I imagine that was a pretty tight sweat there for 5 months, just not knowing.
Well, I had totally surrendered it because, you know, you're up for jobs all the time, and you have to work for them, and, you know, there are not many movies that get developed anymore. So I was working on other stuff. I was not sitting by the phone, but certainly it was a job that I was hoping to have come back around. And it was a very pleasant surprise to get that call. I did jumped as high as I could for a man my age. It wasn't a lot of clearance, but there was some joy.
Now, it's not often to see, I mean, it happens obviously, but, it just feels more frequent that there's multiple writers on a project, and if I'm not mistaken, you are the only credited writer on this film. And
I'm the only one who had anything to do with the writing. It was incredible. Alan Stewart and Frank Marshall are amazing collaborators. There was never a question. It was just we were a team. They gave great notes. We found it together. I delivered the work. And it just went, it was just beautiful. And the only thing that subsumed us, this is, you know, a little movie trivia, it'll make sense to you as soon as you hear it, but the only thing that subsumed us was I was turning in the second draft, and we were all great guns, and Flight came out. And suddenly there's a plane crash movie with a movie star and a big-time director from a large studio. And even though it was fictional, it totally subsumed the space, the airspace, for our movie, and we had to sort of take it into hiding. We developed it a little further and got it to the place we felt like, wow, this is as good as it can be. We're really thrilled, but nobody wanted to make an airplane movie. And also, it was the same problem that initially got Clint to hesitate when his team was telling him to read the script. He had that innate reaction, which was, I know the story. You know, there's no conflict. This guy is a hero, saved everybody on board. That's not a movie. And they just said, keep on reading, just read the script. And the beauty of the old school system and Clint's power because of the success he's had is that we went from moribund to in pre-production in about 15 seconds. Once Clint liked it, we were just off and running.
That's really interesting that you bring that up, his initial reaction to it, because that is kind of my reaction to a lot of topical films that get made. And I know Nick will vouch for me on this one because we oftentimes have discussions about topical films, and Nick likes them more than I do. Not to say I don't like them, some I don't. But I kind of have that, you know, I don't want to sound too highbrow or pretentious here, but I'm going to, where I feel like I'm a little more up to speed on current events and things that have transpired. And when a topical film gets made, it's like, yeah, I already know what happened. You know, it's like I've read about it or I've seen it on the news. And now, you know, my interest has certainly peaked with this film, regardless of me knowing what happens, because of the talent that's involved and because the trailers make it look amazing. But how do you feel about topical films? Or,
well, what's interesting about this movie is that in reaction to one saying that they know the story, which is a, you know, a general reaction, is we have to realize we know the stories that we have been told. We know the accepted wisdom of a story in the news. Everybody knows that Putin is bad and the Maple Leafs are never going to win the Stanley Cup. And, you know, this is sort of like an understanding. But you forget that, oh, what's it like for Putin's wife or his golf caddy? What's it like to be the blade sharpener for the terrible Toronto Maple Leafs? What's it like? You know, you don't actually know the full story of anything. So right away, you know, you're going to unpeel some things and it's going to be more fascinating. But this movie, its raison d'etre is the fact that nobody knows the untold story because only Sully and Skiles knew. And that is what makes this movie old-fashioned, interesting. It's got Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. It's got Anatomy of a Murder. It's got, you know, it has a great courtroom drama in the middle of a movie about personal collapse, because Sully was hailed as a hero and fame as a monster for anybody, even those pursuing it. But he was hailed as a hero at the same time that he had PTSD and the NTSB, a lot of initials there, the NTSB was going after him. They were doing it because it was their job. They have to leave no stone unturned. But his life, his livelihood, his reputation, his pension, every single thing was hinging upon the decision of this group of people. And it took them 18 months. 9 of those months was an aggressive, ongoing investigation. And it was, you know, his heartbeat never settled down from what it hit in the airplane when he was landing the plane. He was in a constant state of palpitation. Now, the nuance we had to do for the movie is we had to take those 9 months of investigation and drill it down to 4 days. So that's really the one artistic license we have, because otherwise you have a television series, a limited series. You just can't delve into all that. But everything else is the story that's true, but no one has heard.
Yeah, that's fascinating to hear. And, I mean, that is something I guess I haven't thought about when I have thought about topical filmmaking. And that kind of leads me to my next question is, as the writer of this story that, quote-unquote, everyone knows, everybody knows who he is, everybody knows what he looks like, how beholden do you feel to the events that actually happened? And, you know, how do you feel about artistic licensing?
No, 100% beholden. And authenticity was driving me, was driving Sully as we worked on the screenplay. You know, he would read and give me his thoughts to make sure we were always authentic for all the aviation stuff and the personal stuff. His relationship with his wife, all that stuff was always drilled down into authenticity. And then when Clint Eastwood comes on board, that's his shield, his sword, and his helmet. That's all he thinks about. Like, is this real? It's why he shoots so quickly, because when he sees through the lens that it's real, that the actor just did his thing, he's like, I have it. It's real. I don't need to see another version of it, because now I know I have the real. And in this movie, we tell the truth. We just tell a truth that hasn't been printed before, because Sully, he referred to it a little bit in his book, but the stuff that he told me, he had only told me and a handful of people. So it was proprietary and fascinating and human and deeply moving.
So you had a chance to collaborate then directly and personally with the real Sully on the script.
I'm adamant about that. I get a lot of jobs to tell true stories, and if the people are alive, I layer into my contract that I'm sent to memorize them. And I just, you know, had to breathe the guy in, find out who he is, find out how he walks, his tics, his likes, what books he reads to his little girls before they go to sleep, every single detail, because the details are, they make up the man. And on top of that, when you talk to someone, when you interview them or you unpack their story, they think they've laid it out in their book or in a sentence, but there's always something hidden in the bushes. And if you pull at that thread, you're like, oh, ooh, what's that? What's that? You're like, you wind up finding a whole sweater. You wind up finding huge chunks of interesting fact, and then you follow those facts. So the real gems are always hidden behind the sentences in a book or alluded to in a throwaway comment at dinner. That's if you just keep investigating, you'll find a deeper and richer truth.
What was your reaction when you heard that Clint Eastwood was going to direct it?
Well, I got a text from my same friend, John Berg, and he was not allowed to tell. So he texted me, holy shit. And then I wrote back ? And then he wrote Sully ? And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he said, oh, sorry, I'm not allowed to tell you. So then I had to wait 10 days until they finally told me. And then a few more days, and then I was on the phone with Clint trying to keep my heart from beating outside my chest.
Now, when you were writing this, did you have anybody pictured in your head as to who would be playing Sully?
No, because I have Sully, you know, and I try to do that right in fictional work, too. I don't want to attach to an actor. It can make you a slave to a style. Big problem in comedy. I've been talking about this week, and I've gotten this question a number of times, and it's a really good question. But in comedy, you'll find, because a guy walks into a bar at my company, we produce and develop comedies. Oftentimes, writers will write to an actor, and you'll feel it, and it might be a funny script, but what in the end you have is, if you don't get that actor, you're not going to get anybody else, because all the other actors will go, oh, well, that's a Will Ferrell movie, or that's a Jack Black movie, or that's an Adam Sandler movie, because they're not just rich characters that any actor could plug into. So definitely avoid thinking about actors until the movie's actually getting made.
And what was your initial reaction? Sorry, go ahead, Nick.
No, Franks, go ahead, and I'll jump in after.
What was your initial reaction when you had heard that Tom Hanks was going to be playing Sully?
I was so thrilled. When Clint first called me at the end of a conversation, he said, what do you think about that Tom Hanks for Sully? You know, as if he were an up-and-coming rookie out of Ottawa. I was like, you know what? I think he's pretty good. I think... you know, I think you can get him there. Why don't you give it a shot? And then that negotiation started. And what's interesting, and Tom has been frank about this. He's so great. He just said that he had prepared to take a long time off. He'd been working movie after movie after movie, and he had even committed to his wife Rita that, you know, this is it. I'm going to finish making Inferno, and then I'm going to take a year off. And while he was shooting Inferno, the script and the offer came in. And when I met him on set, finally, months later, he shook my hand, he pulled me close, and he said, you ruined my life. He said, I just told Rita I'm taking a year off. I just told my agent, no more real-life characters. And then I have to read this.
Yeah, he seems tailor-made for the role, and, you know, I just – this particular story for me is just so fascinating on so many levels, and I think one of the things that just gets me really deeply about it is that anybody could have been on that plane, and you know, just as easily as it went down the way that it did, miraculously, for people who believe in miracles or don't. I mean, it's insane to think that it went down the way that it did with nobody dying, and you know, the wing doesn't clip the water on a certain degree, and it doesn't, you know, just everything happened the right way for all these people to survive. And I think to myself about how literally any one of us could have been on that plane. And when you get on a plane, you put your life in the hands of other people and you surrender to the process of it. And you don't have any say about anything really. And it's a universal thing. I mean, you know, most people do travel and most people, you know, it's a common fear, I think, that so many people have. So this movie, just without even having seen it, it sort of strikes this emotional chord in me as a viewer, because I can easily put myself, you know, on that plane and sort of, you know, think to myself, wow, you know, like this, you know, this is real, this happened, and, you know, anything's possible in life. When you were putting together the script and you were hearing the pieces of information from Sully and you were getting a bigger picture, did sort of like the way that the way that you wanted to tell your story, did it change at all? Or did you have one particular way that you wanted to frame your story, and did it stay that way the whole time?
Yes, I always, from the first pitch, it was always time fractured. I always saw this movie as dealing with this storytelling style I like to appropriate occasionally. I call it the eternal now, which is that everything that's happened to all of us is with us all the time. We remember random things. Remember Jimmy Hungerford, and, you know, remember first dates and falling in love with our wives. But much of what's occurred to us, we don't remember. We don't have quick access to it, but it's in us. And then there's what's happening right now in the present, and then how the present impacts the future. So all these things are happening constantly and eternally. And it's a great storytelling style for a memoir, because every memory is a trigger. And I hate flashbacks. So when you're with an actor, and this is such a subjective movie seen through Sully's experience, when you're with an actor, you can drift into their eye, you can just push past their shoulder, and you can go anywhere you want. And then you can slingshot back when that scene is over and land right exactly where you were before because of this notion of the eternal now. And the guys executed the material at the highest level. So there's a seamlessness to how the story unfolds, even though it's completely time fractured.
It might be just me, but the eternal now sounds like the Terminator timeline traveling.
Well, I try to look at it as slightly cheerier than that.
No, but seriously, man, that's fascinating. I've never heard
Thanks,
it put
brother.
That way before.
Yeah, it's in The God 4, too, because The God 4 is a memory movie that takes place present day and 10 years ago on the exact same campus where everything happened for these kids, and now they're adults returning after the death of a friend. And so it really serves that story, too. I love it. It gives freedom, and it also connects the audience to the actors in a way that's so personal, because you see what they're suffering and you see how they felt in another time and how it's shaded into the older version of themselves.
Now, I know that, obviously you're not the editor of the film, but I've been trying to stay away from reading full on reviews. I've been skimming some things here and there. And I did read about how this movie is relatively short given Clint Eastwood's other recent films and his penchant for making a movie a little bit longer than 2 hours. Was your screenplay like is what you wrote essentially shot? Because I've heard things about Clint Eastwood that he gets a script, he likes it, he shoots on the page, and there's not too much messing around. Is that basically the way that it works?
100% the experience. I mean, there are a couple of things that just because of technical issues or just how the weight of a scene played out when it was finally shot based on this actor or that actor. I mean, there's a couple of things that are missing, but it was always a very taut, lean story. And it needed to be, because it's a juggernaut. You have to get people right away, and it's a plane crash movie. So like you said earlier, Nick, very eloquently, everybody knows what it's like to be in that seat and give away that power. And I'm a big fan of the moments in the film where, and this is in the trailer, where this, you know, this woman hears Brace for Impact, and the sword just blows by her, and she just says, "What?" Like, you do not want to have just taken off and hear Brace for Impact. You don't even, it's like you have to prepare to die suddenly. And of course, that's the expectation. Once this thing is happening, no one thinks they're going to, first of all, they don't know where they're landing. He never told them they're landing on water. And second of all, you're in a plane, and they say Brace for Impact. that's, you know, text I love you to your husband and say goodbye. So the intensity of the passenger stories is a big part of the movie.
You're just thinking about the weight of what it must have been like for those people. And did you speak to any of the survivors?
You keep taking all my questions, but that's
not
a good question.
Well, it's a, no, it was just the passenger stories that are highlighted in the movie are all drawn from news reports. So, we spoke to Skiles and to Sully, because it's really their movie, you know, primarily Sully's movie. But there were a lot of news reports out there about little details that certain passengers experienced, and that gave us the brushstrokes we needed.
How long would you say you spent developing this? Writing it and developing it and to where it was shot?
A lot of time
it's
been researching. I mean, this is going to be a guess, but I would say I did at least 4 or 5 months of just research. And then probably overall with the back and forth and the rewrites and such, probably 6 or 7 months of writing. It was long for a screenplay.
And what's your favorite process of writing?
Well, I like to go to the local pub, Walker's, which is just around the corner from us, and do a lot of late night writing. And my wife and kids are incredibly understanding about my late night sojourns to the pen to paper. So I do a lot of late night writing. And before we had kids, my life was very, very straightforward. It was wake up at 8:30, read the paper, coffee, 10 o'clock. Right from 10 to 1, take an hour break for lunch, and then 2 to 6, go back to work. An 8-hour work day, because I always wanted to be a lunch pail writer. I wanted to be a guy who never missed his deadlines, always showed up for work, didn't treat it like it was esoteric or about some, oh, where's my inspiration, do not believe in writer's block, complete myth, and just show up for work. Of course, once you have kids, that's completely out the window. So now it's been much more, write when I can, grab an hour here at this cafe, an hour and a half at this restaurant, and do some late night writing at Walker's, and sort of compile enough throughout the day that you get a whole working day in, but it's much more divided up.
Yeah, certainly I am not writing screenplays on the level of Sully, but having a nine month old child at home, I can certainly attest to the way that schedules change, certainly, it's your life becomes completely different, in a more fulfilling aspect for sure. But I can only imagine.
It's not yours anymore. Your time is not yours. When you first fall in love, your time becomes shared, and you think of your partner more than you think of yourself in an ideal situation. But when you have a baby, it's very, very clear that your time does not belong to you anymore.
No, I've been realizing that as much as I try to resist that and try to think in my own head maybe that it is my time. No, it's all his time. But that's cool. Again, you live and you learn, and children inform aspects of your life that you're not prepared to experience, until they're actually happening right in front of you. So. When you took on this job, did you sort of like have to put yourself as a husband and a father and obviously as a human being, did you have to put yourself on that plane and sort of make yourself, think about what it would have been like to get to a specific spot for yourself, like as a writer?
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of, you think of method acting. It's a little old-fashioned now, but some people do that. But I think they're in writing, if you can't go on that journey with your imagination to really get inside someone's skin, you're not going to be able to pull off much. So there is a little method writing, which is deep imaginative work and really listening to the voice of the man and seeing what he struggles through and what he's facing, and try to disappear into the character as much as possible. To me, the thing that is fundamental when I'm working on a script is that by the time I'm ready to send it in, I am totally invisible. That there's no joke that is like, oh, that's such a Todd joke. If there's a joke, it should be a Jeff Skiles style joke. It should be a Sully joke. It should not be evidentiary that it's my joke. In the same way, if there's an emotional beat, if it's me telling the character to behave in a way that I would, then it's bad writing. If it's exactly as how they would behave, then I've achieved something. So I really just try to vanish in the process in the end and leave no fingerprints.
So in a sense, you disappear into each character as you're writing them, regardless of how prominent they are in what you're writing?
Yes, yes. And you have to be able to do it within a scene. You have to go back and forth between those things, and that's why it takes drafts. You have to, you know, a first draft could be really strong with Sully, but, you know, Skyle's a little bit behind, or really strong with the air traffic control guy, Patrick Harton, or a little light on Laurie Sullenberger. So you need time to get everybody up to that same level. I have a gentleman who runs my company. His name is Jonathan Coleman, and he is my backstop. He's my editor, and until I have passed muster with him, I won't send it in to the studio. I won't turn it in, and he's an ass kicker. So his rule is every scene in the script has to be as good as the best scene. So what happens there is, you know, you might work on something, and five drafts ago, or for the last five drafts, there's been a scene that's totally worked, and you're not going to touch it. It's flawless. But as the rest of the script improves, that scene can be left behind. And you have to look at that and say, okay, you love that scene the whole time. It's got to go, or it's got to elevate to match where the script is now. So it's that constant process of honing and just professionalism.
What's that feel like to be able to do that, to disappear inside somebody regardless of their grand substance to the finished product?
Well, it's a mystical thing. I think it's a very spiritual thing. You know, Bono has this great quote. Somebody said to him, why do you always go to the studio? Even in between records, you always go to the studio with your guitar. And he said, I just want to be there when God walks through the room. And unless you're sitting in the chair with your pen in your hand, or, you know, for people who write on keyboards with a keyboard in front of you, you can't be available to the mystery that's going to occur. So being available and then watching it happen is really beautiful. And over time, I'm 50 years old now, so I've written three novels and I've written a zillion movies. You know, the studios don't make hardly anything that they hire you for. So I don't have a deep resume of produced screenplays, but I've certainly been writing it for many years for the studios. And what you wind up with is the notion that telling the truth, the only way to really tell the truth is to be completely invisible, get completely out of the way. And in order to do that, you have to sort of surrender and stay wide open, not be precious about your work, be open to surprises. For me, I'm a Christian, so it's central to my life. So for me, there's a tremendous amount of prayer around what I do. And surrender is the big word. I don't want anything to point to me. I wouldn't want anyone to see this movie. I want them to love the movie, but I don't want them to say, oh, that's such a Komernicki thing. He just did a Komernicki thing. I don't want that. I really like the notion of being invisible. I think that's the best work. And Clint today said beautifully at a press reception, he said, the marriage of good writing and good acting is that the audience believes that the actors are making up the lines as they happen. But of course they're not. But they've made it so personal and so their own that invisible bridge has been crossed between script and performance.
Jesus. Yeah, man, that's amazing. That's so cool.
I wanted to ask Power. you brought up an interesting point that you've been writing for a while, and you know, there you don't have as deep of a produced, you know, resume as some other people. And you know, we've certainly had chats with numerous writers on our show, Peter Iliff, William Wisher, Daniel Waters, and you know, they've all done that sort of work too, and you know, they've described their experiences. Just in general, what is it like to work on screenplays that you get paid for, but that actually never see the light of day? Do they feel like abandoned children or pets that are just left to roam the wilderness without any sort of guidance? Or, you know, is the door shut on them thematically? Do you think about that kind of stuff? Or How does that work?
I feel like they're more like children. They're more like children that you can't get out of the house. You know, no school will take them. Nobody will play with them. And you're like, these kids are awesome. And so you wind up having a very crowded house. So the you never give up on them. I mean, there's some, you have to be honest, there's some that you go back and look at and say, you know what, it's not as good as I thought it was. You know, I swung and missed. But there's some that you just never give up on, and you wait and you wait and you wait for that time, and you keep hope alive. And my writer friends and I always say, no doesn't mean no, it just means not now. So you can't bank on those things, but you definitely, they're your kids. They're always going to be your kids. You worked hard on them. You care about them. Often they're adaptations of beautiful novels or true stories that mean a lot to you, and you think could it bring some blessing to the world. So, yeah, you don't give up on the kids. Some are uglier than others, but you still like to have them close.
Yeah, the not right now mentality is a very cool thing to subscribe to, especially in an industry where people are paid to say no on a daily basis. So I like, you know, at least that was my limited experience when I was nothing in the industry, getting people coffee, and what I observed, and it was certainly conveyed to me that Hollywood is – unfortunately, a big bowl of no for a lot of people. So that's nice to hear you say that. Obviously, want to be mindful of your time, and you, because you've been so awesome to chat with us in this fashion. We'd love to hear about a little bit about the movie that you're working on. Sounds like you're working on a film. You're writing and directing a movie called The God Four with Michael Douglas and Jai Courtney, Natalie Dormer, Brenton Thwaites. What can you tell us about this?
Well, that's another outgrowth of Sully. It's a job I got after I wrote Sully. It's a novel that I adapted. The novel's called The Flatwater Tuesday, terrific book about prep school rowing. And what I saw in the book was an opportunity to essentially do Dead Poets Society against prep school rowing. And it's a world when I look, and you guys have both survived adolescence, so you'll understand this, but I honestly believe that there's this invisible tightrope between adolescence and young adulthood, and they don't tell you that you're on this high wire, but all of us are on it. And inevitably, some of us are going to fall. And inevitably, those who fall will take someone with them. Now, it doesn't always mean death plus death. It could be death and loss or grief. It could be just drug abuse and disappearing. It could be anything. But it's so difficult and precarious to get through adolescence. And this movie, The God Four, is an x-ray of those years and showing what the survivors did to survive and what it's cost them.
Sounds pretty great. Yeah.
I'm assuming here that Michael Douglas is playing some sort of professor role, maybe? Or
yeah, he's the coach. He's the teacher and the rowing coach. I mean, such a gentleman. On his own, went up and visited the rowing coach at the prep school that we were talking to, and just immediately delved in and just full bore an actor's actor. Just amazing man.
It's awesome. Yeah, Frank and I are big fans of Michael Douglas. It's so awesome to see that he's gotten healthier and he's back in front of cameras making movies. He's one of the best actors ever. And I've been a fan my whole life, and that's great. That's very cool to hear.
What's one of your favorite Michael Douglas performances?
Let me answer that in a second. What's interesting about Michael Douglas is that he's a movie star who actually happens to be a super, super good actor. You know, he's in there where Brad Pitt really got his footing and stopped being cute and started being just running deep. And Michael Douglas was a pretty boy. You know, he was a TV star. And he was doing Romancing the Stone, and where he went with his performances, deeper and deeper and deeper, and always asking more questions. And he's just, he's really a special actor. Falling Down is hard to beat, I would say. And I would probably put just ahead of that The Game.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. Frank and I love The Game so much that we recorded a commentary track. You can find it on our website if you're interested. We are massively obsessed with The Game.
Obsessed with The Game, yes.
Let's talk about The Game, because here's a heartbreaker for film fans. See if you agree with me. That movie is one decision away from being maybe one of the 10 best films ever made. And that decision is that it was all a game. And he winds up having a chance to go hang out with Deborah Scott Unger. I forget her name. Deborah Carr Unger. The movie should have ended when he jumps. He jumps off that building. Sean Penn sits up. We're shocked. Sean Penn's alive. And at the bottom on the street is the man they tried to entertain, and they killed him. And he jumped just like his father jumped. That is the perfect ending. And the end of that movie is so disappointing and so vacuous and also so impossible to believe that it really – I still love the movie, but it really injured a big part of that movie for me.
I never thought of it that way. I honestly don't even know if they ever actually do have that cup of coffee at the airport. Like, I don't think that – like, you know, the thing for me with that movie is that – you could watch it a million times and you could say to yourself every time when it starts, when does the game start? When is it actually ended? You know, what is truly going on? What are all the hidden meanings? You know, I've always interpreted the movie as one big suicide intervention, and I don't care what other people say, if that's true or not or blah, blah, blah. That's just the way I've always read it. I read it.
That's a very loving way to look at that. I could see that. That's nice.
Yeah, I always saw it as Sean Penn basically saying, I know my brother's fucked mentally. He's at the same age as our father. He's following the same footsteps as our father. We can't allow this to happen. Whether or not he had his whole game experience is irrelevant. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But he finds out about this thing that can help potentially save his brother. And, you know, for me, that's how I always –
a lot of pipe there, though. I know, but you're laying a lot of pipe that's not in there. Now, see, in Fincher's courageous ending, which is 7, where the good guy becomes unmoored and it's all loss, that I get. That resonates. And I think that's why that movie has – more people would say they would choose 7 than the game.
Oh, yeah.
A larger group of people saying that. So I just love the courage. In fact, let's go to Fincher again. You know, the movie that frustrates me the most – we'd love to talk about this – is that Fight Club, at its very heart, has such a story flaw that it shouldn't even exist as a movie. Because the entire premise of the movie, and the movie's impeccably made. I mean, there's no argument about the glory of his talent. But the whole premise of the movie is that Fight Clubs grew up out of young, disaffected men watching Ed Norton beat the shit out of himself. Because there is no Brad Pitt. There is no Brad Pitt. So Edward Norton, alone in a parking lot, punching himself in the face, creates a movement of young men who want to fight each other? No, it creates a poor guy getting taken to Bellevue. So there's no movie. Literally, that movie should not exist. And when I watched that movie, I was so upset. I was like, there's no movie. There's no movie. And, you know, I just think it's a big magic trick, that movie. So that's not my favorite.
Interesting. Yeah, that movie has meant a lot of different things to me throughout the years. I think that it's a very, 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 like you said, just the construction of that movie is just it's amazing. I mean, like I just think that David Fincher is just so talented in terms of visual storytelling and communicating ideas through, you know, atmosphere and everything else. And there's always been something about Fight Club that's always just like grabbed me and, you know, kind of just shoved its ugly face around, you know, for so long. But
I'll jump in on the Fincher love here. I mean, Fincher's one of my favorite filmmakers. I think The Game is my favorite movie of his. I think his best movie is Zodiac. But when it comes to Fight Club, I feel like I'm the only person in the world that I have this disconnect with the movie, and I can't quite figure out what it is. And maybe
because
it has
shouldn't
something
exist.
To do with
it. I just explained it to you. It shouldn't exist. That's why you have a disconnect.
Jesus.
Because it's a non-entity.
I mean, I think aesthetically it's amazing.
Yes.
You know,
but isn't
how it's crafted? But
isn't that sort of the comment? That like, I mean, like, you couldn't you read it that you have this group of people who are willing to believe in anything, even a guy who's willing to beat the shit out of himself? and that there are people.
The movie is like photographed food. You know, it's gorgeous, but it's been so sprayed with shit and overlit that if you go to eat it, it just rankles in the mouth. It just, there's no soul. There's no there. You know, it's like Los Angeles. There's no there.
That I can agree with you on, having lived there for almost 10 years. For me, the game is my favorite movie by Fincher. I've been obsessed with it for years. I think Seven and Zodiac are probably maybe his best overall efforts. But he's just, you know, when you're trying to rank movies by guys like Fincher and, you know, Mann and some of these other filmmakers who mean so much, it's always you just end up playing favorites, you know, because there are certain filmmakers who you just really respond to. And it's interesting. I've always seen Fight Club as a premier black comedy. I did when I first saw it in the theater when I was 19 or whatever the hell, you know, when did that movie come out? 99? Yeah, 19. I always remember laughing my ass off at that movie and just finding it so funny. But I never really took stock into the fact that, you know, it's completely ludicrous in the sense that he's a guy beating the shit out of himself. But
I just drank Todd's Kool-Aid, not because I'm an ass kiss, but because that makes total sense.
Doesn't it? It's so satisfying. And people are so stubborn about it that there are very few people that do that, like what you just did, Frank. So God bless you.
Thank you. Amen. I could walk. it's been a while since I've seen Fight Club. It took me a long time to warm up to Social Network because I thought my initial reaction to Social Network was, oh my God, this movie is just impeccably made, but I don't give a shit about any of the characters.
What did you think about Gone Girl?
Oh man. Okay. I think Gone Girl is David Fincher directing a Lifetime movie. And I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way. I've rewatched it a couple of times. I think it's impeccably made, like everything that Fincher has done, but it's not a David Fincher movie.
It's
ice cold. It's ice cold. It's hateful people doing hateful things, no one to root for, and also it's absolutely deadening central performance by the male lead. So there's just no way to step in and say I'm rooting for this or rooting for that. And then the story cheat of the obsessed fan and how that sets her up to be able to create an out. I mean,
that's what really lost me was the Neil Patrick Harris storyline. I was just kind of like, okay.
Then you get that crazy scene that Fincher you knew wanted to bust out. My whole feeling on Fincher is that he is ridiculously talented, and I honestly want to see more stuff like Seven, Fight Club, The Game, Zodiac. Like, I'm kind of done with, like, quote unquote airport thrillers. Like, Girl with the dragon tattoo. You know, was very well made and it was really well done, but it felt like to me that it was material that you've covered in certain ways. You know,
let me jump in here. I'm still in the mic. No. Okay. Yeah, that was a dick move.
What I wanted to say about Gone Girl is, Todd, did you see the movie Force Majeure?
I didn't.
See, that movie is the movie that Gone Girl, in my opinion, wishes that it was. Force Majeure is a masterpiece. It's absolutely incredible. There is nothing wrong with it. It's like you can't believe what you're watching. Force Majeure is the Swedish film about the family that goes to the ski resort. And
it's from just a handful of years ago. I remember hearing about it, but I never saw it.
And there's an avalanche, and the whole movie is a thematic discussion of cowardice, of family, and of what people are really thinking, whether or not their reaction and whether or not the reaction is the right thing. So basically what happens is this avalanche occurs.
I'll see it.
I'm not going to tell you everything, but certain people respond to it in a different way, which pisses off people, and basically a husband and wife go to war while they're on a family vacation, and the ending is excruciatingly tense. I mean, like, there is a 15-minute sequence where you are on pins and needles. Like, you don't know what's going to happen. So I highly recommend – I
can't
highly
wait to see
recommend
it.
Force Majeure. And, like, the director – I remember reading, like, the director visually manipulated every shot with a computer. Like, it was all shot on film, I guess, or digitally or what have you. But he took, like, a year in post – and he tweaked every single shot to, like, a really specific degree. It's worth reading about. It's really worth seeing. It's a great movie. But go ahead, Frank, about Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah, let me circle back here to the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. That was a movie I saw opening day. I think it was, like, Christmas. Yeah, it was Christmas. The day before, whenever it opened, the week of Christmas, I was underwhelmed by it. I was really engaged with the story. I hadn't seen the original film. I was really engaged with it. I love Daniel Craig. I love Christopher Plummer. Rooney Mara's awesome. But I didn't like the ending. And I just thought the ending was just such a shitty cop out, which isn't a reflection upon Fincher because it's already based on source material. The novel, the other film, or I should say the original film. But I have to say that, like, aside from Seven, Zodiac, and The Game, I find myself always wanting to rewatch Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, even though I'm not in love with it as much as I am by the ending. By the ending, I'm pretty much, like, tuned out. But there are just scenes, man. You know, when the big reveal happens and Daniel Craig's putting everything together and he's got his, like, glasses hanging off of his face and he's, like, leaning back from the computer. Or I swear to God, this is, like, probably one of my favorite scenes in recent memory is when fucking Stellan Skarsgård has him, like, suspended with the gag in his mouth and Enya starts playing. And it's just, like, one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my entire life.
Isn't that what, like, Daniel Craig said, that he would rather have that happen in real life than play Bond again?
Dude, now you just opened up a fucking can of worms.
Podcast.
Because this is a whole other podcast because I'm fucking – I don't care who's telling me what or whatever bullshit Tom Hiddleston's going to be the next Bond or all these, like, young actors that Sony is, like, trying to court around. It's Daniel Craig's going to be back as James Bond, man. There's no doubt in my mind. At least one more, if not two.
I mean, he's contracted for another Bond movie, so, like...
He has an option for another Bond movie, but, I mean, they're going to pay him whatever he wants to be in it. You're not going to set up the Blofeld trilogy, and then he's going to leave. It's just, I'm a Bond diehard, and I fucking can't go through another reboot. Because if they end with Craig, somebody like Christopher Nolan's going to come in with some fucking One Direction guy and just, like, reboot Bond, and I'm gonna have to endure the rebooting of James Bond again. Thanks, Todd.
Right now, I just want to hold you just for a minute.
Yeah,
to get you through this moment.
I need somebody to hold me right now and stroke my beard because, like,
I'm gonna hold you right now. I'm not gonna stroke your beard, but I'm gonna hold you right now. So just let's all hush for a minute here on the podcast. It's gonna be okay. Hey guys,
Todd.
I've got a beautiful wife who I need to go nurture. Who
yes.
is a little prettier than you guys.
Me.
Thanks very, very, very much, Todd. It was honestly an extreme pleasure, and we will certainly be in touch to get on your case about Miami Vice. We'll set that aside and we'll get into everything. You got to watch it again, though.
No,
you got
to
promise.
We need to put that on the books. We need
okay.
to put that on the books and
October.
No,
seriously,
over.
That's going to happen.
Miami Vice.
I'll follow up with you. Don't worry.
Yeah, trust me. Nick will message you within 15 minutes of you hanging up.
All right. It's going to be a Miami Vice takedown. For any of you who are on various sides of the battle, I am anti-device, and these cats dig it hard. So we're going to be bringing the noise. We're going to be bringing the jazz and pay attention. And don't forget to vote. And pick your winner, which we will all ignore anyway. But don't forget to pretend that you are impacting our decisions about this woeful film that poor Nick cherishes.
I don't have anything to follow that up with. So
I look.
Yeah, you guys are the best. You guys are the best. You love movies. I've enjoyed every second talking to you. Thank you for reaching out to me. enjoy Sully, and let's talk in October.
You bet.
Sounds fantastic, man. Seriously, thank you so very much for your time, though. This was really incredible to speak with you.
Oh, thanks, brothers. Peace be with you.
Thanks a lot, man.